Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Utah Governor Spencer Cox wins a re-election race full of twists and turns and claims of fraud and corruption. After the gondola drama, UDOT has other ideas for eliminating the red snake in Big Cottonwood Canyon. And at the site of one of the deadliest massacres of Native Americans in U.S. history, hundreds seek to heal spirits and soil. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Later on, we'll be hearing from Outdoors reporter Julie Jagg and Utah Public Radio and Cache Valley reporter Clarissa Casper. We'll start with Robert Gerke. So the election, let's start with Governor Cox, who, after all those twists and turns, won a fairly solid victory, although he underperformed President Trump, I believe.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think he was about a point behind where President Trump finished. But, you know, I think the Phil Lyman factor probably had something to do with that. Phil Lyman, the Republican nominee or Republican opponent in the primary, who refused to acknowledge that he lost the election and ran a write-in campaign, got about 9%. So those votes all obviously came out of the tally, Brett, that, you know, the Republican voters base that Cox would have counted on. So I think that's part of that factor there.
I believe Brian King conceded. I don't know if we've heard from Representative Lyman.
Sorry. Yeah, that's right. Representative King called Governor Cox about 9, well, I guess about 10 o'clock on election night, and congratulated him on his victory. As far as we know, we have not heard from Representative Lyman. You know, that was a much more, I don't know, sort of toxic race with all of the allegations that Representative Lyman was throwing around about election fraud and illegitimate governors and things like that. You know, and it's sort of a reflection, I think, also of, you know, what we see in national politics. It's not something we typically see in local races, but, you know, it's filtering, I guess, into the local political scene as well now.
Now, while the Republican Party did not really entertain Representative Lyman's accusations, the Speaker and the Senate President to shut him down, I think there's still not only this race but in others residual anger about the process that we have, this dual process, right, where if you lose at convention, you can go on to get signatures and get on the primary ballot.
I mean, I guess there's probably anger from some people who don't like to have to go to a primary, like Representative Lyman didn't want to do. I think by and large, you know, the public seems to like the signature path. I think rather than just leaving it up to, you know, the convention delegates, you know, if you look at this election and our statewide races in particular, Governor Cox, Senator-elect John Curtis, Attorney General-elect Derrick Brown, all three of them did take the signature path, and now they're going to be, you know, statewide office holders. So I think, you know, there are some factions in the Republican Party in the Phil Lyman world, I guess, who don't like having a signature path to the ballot, but it seems to be that, you know, the most elected candidates for statewide office now have taken that path. So I don't know that it's necessarily going to be going away. But there will be discussion. There will be efforts to try to undermine it in some way during the legislative session. And so I guess we'll have to save that for another show back down the road.
So Governor Cox did make some comments, I believe. What does he take from this, his victory? What does he think it means?
You know, he didn't, he mostly was talking about how he, you know, thanking the people of Utah, thanking the people who worked on his campaign, thanking his everybody else who ran, thanking Representative Brian King. He's says that, he was talking about the amount of accomplishments they had during his first term, and talking about looking forward to his second term, wanting to his big goal is this trying to get 35,000 starter homes built in the next 5 years. That's sort of been his main target. And just all of the things he's got to do going forward. So I think it's look, it wasn't I don't think it was a surprise to anybody that Governor Cox won. I mean, if you look at he is an incumbent governor, the economy's doing quite well. He's, doesn't have a major scandal, and he also raised $7 million to run his campaign, which, Representative King outspent, or he outraised Representative King about 10 to 1, 9 to 1, I guess. But so the outcome of this election was not really a surprise. And the margin was, given that there was a three-way race, I think the margin was fairly healthy for him.
Of course, Governor Cox had been a Trump critic. He then, after the assassination attempt, endorsed Trump. He did make some comments. This was not in your story, but other stories I noticed about Trump's victory. And I think he made an analogy. He said, "We've been pulling against a parachute, slowing us down. And now with President Trump in, we'll be able to go forward faster." I guess less regulation. He might also be referring to public lands.
He did say on election night that he was hopeful that they could that the state could work with President Trump, President-elect Trump. So he said, it's going to be easier to work with President-elect Trump than it was with President Biden, who they had to sue. He said 60 times. I don't have a full inventory of all those lawsuits that were filed, but so I think the endorsement, I think, does have the benefit of giving the governor a more receptive audience, I guess, if there's something the state needs to have done. And yeah, I think with President Trump's election, we will see some fairly significant changes for residents of Utah, or for at least, the government leadership in the state.
I guess one more thing on Governor Cox. He has said that he's not going to run again. This is his last term.
Correct. He said that before the primary, I guess, that he wasn't going to be seeking a third term. So, that kind of makes him instantly, I guess, a lame duck the day he's inaugurated, but he's, got 4 years to accomplish the things he wants to do. And it opens the field, I guess, for people who might want to run in 2028, whether that's, Phil Lyman or whoever, and so there will be people jockeying for that, but that's also down the road as well.
One thing that struck me, to move on to other races here, but just in general, reading through your stories and other coverage from the Tribune, it struck me the large disparity in money raised and spent, Republicans versus the Democratic, United Utah, Utah Forward parties. I guess that goes mostly to the primaries because those are where it's really contested.
Well, no, I don't think that's exclusively the primaries, to be honest. But yeah, as you mentioned, Governor Cox raising $7 million. Derrick Brown, I think, got to 1.2 million. And some of these Democrats, Rudy Batista, who ran for attorney general against Derrick Brown, the 1.2 that Derrick raised and spent versus the $160 that Rudy Batista gave to his campaign. Now, he said that that was because he didn't want to be beholden or owe anything to any donors, and he said that's been a problem that in the attorney general's office that he wanted to avoid. But you just simply can't be competitive when you spend $160 on a statewide race. That's unrealistic, and I respect, I guess, the intent behind it, you know, to avoid the appearance of having owing somebody something. But you know, you've also got to run a race, you've got to run a campaign, and you've got to be a legitimate candidate, or else you shouldn't be in the race. So and it was up and down the ticket, you know. Sure. And this is standard. Let's be clear. Like, Republicans always outspend the Democrat in the race, or almost always outspend the Democrat. And this year was no exception. Caroline Gleick was outspent by a large margin. You know, it kind of comes with the it comes. You kind of have to expect it if you're a Democrat getting into the race, that you're going to be outspent. But you're going to have to. You know, especially when you're going against an incumbent like Governor Cox, who has the sort of the leverage to raise large amounts of money, you're gonna have to, I guess, try to outwork them, or some other, you know, overcome that advantage in some other way. But yeah, the Cox fundraising total in particular was kind of striking, because the $7 million he raised was about double what Governor Herbert raised 8 years ago, and it's about $2 million more than Cox raised 4 years ago. And so we kind of see this escalating cost of doing business, I guess, if you're going to run for statewide office. And it makes it difficult, I think, for, you know, any challenger. You know, Phil Lyman raised quite a bit of money for a intra-party challenge, I guess, but it's difficult for anybody to kind of compete with that sort of whopping fundraising total.
So we have some new people in office because of retirements or people running for other office. So a new U.S. senator, new attorney general, new representative of the 3rd District. Maybe start with John Curtis. Pretty big victory. He now replaces Mitt Romney.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting if you look at the statewide races up and down the ballot, right? Not just the statewide races, but the Democrats sort of had this 30% cap. They were beaten basically by a margin of 2 to 1 by their Republican opponents, and that's about what it was in John Curtis's race. John Curtis, yeah, after he won the primary, it was, you know, the polls all showed him leading by a large margin. So yeah, he'll be replacing Mitt Romney. He moves from his 3rd District seat up to the Senate, and that created that opening that Michael Kennedy was the Republican nominee. State Senator Michael Kennedy was the nominee, and so he won his race quite easily, and so he'll be going to the represent that 3rd Congressional District. You mentioned Derrick Brown, who Sean Reyes is stepping aside, retiring as Attorney General. And again, once Derrick won that primary, it's sort of a theme in these races, I guess. Once you win the Republican primary, you can kind of coast in. And so he'll be the incoming Attorney General. Yeah.
I noticed they held a fast election. I guess this is usual for the House of Representatives. Mike Schultz appears is going to return as Speaker.
Yeah. Typically, after the election results are finalized, both the House and Senate caucuses, Democrat and Republican, get together and elect their respective leadership. The Republicans held their caucuses last night to have these leadership elections, and is basically returning the leadership team that they had previously. So Speaker Schultz will be the Speaker, Jefferson Moss, Carrie-Anne Lisenby, and Casey Snyder will be the, you know, sort of round out the leadership team. Over in the Senate, there were some changes. You know, Speaker Adams, or President Adams, is still going to be at the helm, but Evan Vickers will be replaced by Kirk Cullimore. You got Mike McKell joining the leadership team as the assistant whip, and then the whip will be, oh boy, I just forgot. Sorry about that. But yeah, so McKell Cullimore moving up, and McKell joining the leadership team, and Milner is going to be replaced by Chris Wilson, sorry, as the whip. So a little bit of change there. I think there was sort of from what I gather, talking to the senators, it was they kind of wanted some fresh blood, I guess, in the leadership team, and so they've got Representative or Senator Wilson and Senator McKell joining the lineup there.
What I haven't looked at the whether Republicans or Democrats made gains. The majorities in both House and Senate about the same as they were.
So that is interesting because when we've talked about on this program before about particularly about Amendment D and that whole the roller coaster that happened there, there was this sense that oh boy, the Republicans may have overstepped and now they're going to have to pay some political consequences for that. They didn't pay any political consequences to in a meaningful way on election night. There was one House seat in West Valley City that ended up going from Republican to Democrat, Jake Pittisamanu, who's a West Valley City councilman, ended up winning an open seat. So he's gonna, but that's the only seat that went from Republican to Democrat. So Republicans maintained their supermajority in both the House and the Senate. And we'll have, I guess, a lot of latitude when it comes to setting policy for the, for at least the coming sessions.
So the constitutional amendments, as you mentioned, much in the news, A and D did not count. The votes were not counted. But I guess voters did pass B and C.
Correct. They passed. They both passed with over 80% support. They weren't really controversial. If they had been, it would have all it would have taken was would have been somebody to go file a lawsuit to challenge them, and they would have been kicked off the ballot. But since there wasn't really any opposition to them, and Amendment C in particular apparently doesn't really do much of anything anyway. It's, it says that county sheriffs have to be elected, which they all are in this state anyway. So Amendment B it will. Means a little bit more money from school trust funds that will be distributed or dispersed to to local schools, and so that is not a super controversial proposal either. So yeah, it's gonna both of them pass by huge margins.
I don't know what the ruling was in the end on A and D. Were the votes processed? I think we're not going to know what the count was. I'm sure curious, but I don't think we're going to know.
You and me both. Yeah. My understanding is that no, they will not be releasing. They did not release any tallies. There, we've asked if we can file an open records request for those totals, but it sounds like they were not actually counted. The machines were not programmed to count those, so they don't actually have the totals. So we're not going to find out what the margins were on that. So, but yeah, I'm with you. I'm curious to see how they would have done had people voted for it. And it would not be a real accurate figure anyway, I guess, because some people didn't vote on it because they knew it was kicked off, or some people probably did vote on it because they wanted to make a point, but we're not going to find that out.
Finally, Robert, the third parties, United Utah Party has been around for a while, Utah Forward. They're fielding candidates in some offices, and I don't know if they're making progress. It seemed like the biggest vote total in any of these races was like 5 or 6% from some of these candidates.
Yeah, it was probably a little bit disappointing night for some of the independent and third party candidates. Michelle Quist probably, I think she finished a little over 7%. And she, she was running for attorney general, and it's hard to make a name for yourself as a third party candidate. But she campaigned a lot harder than the Democrat in the race, but it seemed like on this election in particular, if you're have a D by your name, you get 30% whether you do anything or not in the race. So there are several legislative candidates who were unaffiliated who were running up in your neck of the woods. Utah State Professor Patrick Belmont was running for a legislative seat, things like that. And there were they targeted the districts in particular, where Evan McMullen had done well when he challenged Mike Lee 2 years ago, thinking that maybe they could replicate that with an unaffiliated or independent candidate. And some of them did quite well. I mean, but they none of them actually ended up winning their races. So now I guess we kind of wait for 2 years and see if they are encouraged by what the results were in the in those races, if they try it again, or if this was just an experiment that they decided isn't going to pay off and, abandon it.
Robert Gerke, news columnist, Salt Lake Tribune, helping us to understand the returns from Tuesday night. Thanks, Robert.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. After a break, we're going to be talking with Salt Lake Tribune Outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. Here's the headline. After the gondola drama, UDOT has other ideas for eliminating the red snake in Big Cottonwood Canyon. More following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. And we turn next to Salt Lake Tribune Outdoors reporter Julie Jagg. Julie, thanks so much for joining us.
Ski season is here. I'm so excited. Thanks for having me.
It certainly is, yeah. This story, here's the headline. After the gondola drama, UDOT has other ideas for eliminating the red snake in Big Cottonwood Canyon. The red snake, of course, being that line of cars and the taillights are the red eyes, right?
Yes, exactly. Yep, all those taillights you see going up and down the single lane whenever you're going to those resorts.
So for people not familiar, I've never skied in those two canyons, Little Cottonwood and Big Cottonwood. So we're talking here about Big Cottonwood Canyon, but Little Cottonwood is the one that had the gondola drama, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and I gotta say, you're missing out if you haven't skied those. Those are
I'll have
really
to get
good
up there.
Resorts.
I live in Utah. I should get up there.
Yeah, exactly. But
so,
yeah, Little Cottonwood's the one that it had UDOT proposed the gondola to put up there, or accept that as the plan of action to deal with traffic up there. But that is currently on hold because UDOT has been sued by is in the middle of three different lawsuits pertaining to the gondola. So until those are resolved, then nothing will really happen in that canyon.
Okay. Situate for us which ski resorts are where. So start with Little Cottonwood. What's at the top of Little Cottonwood?
Sure. Top of Little Cottonwood is Alta Ski Area. And then right below that is Snowbird.
Okay.
And then top of Big Cottonwood Canyon is Brighton, and then right below that is Solitude.
Okay. So right now we're talking about, and this story talks about Big Cottonwood Canyon, Utah Department of Transportation. They're, I guess, in the middle of a environmental impact statement. They're trying to figure out what to do with Big Cottonwood.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, we've talked, ad nauseum about the traffic of Little Cottonwood Canyon, but the same thing is happening at Big Cottonwood Canyon. It's a longer canyon, so maybe it took a little longer to come home to roost, but the skiers and snowboarders going up there are having the same issues with having to deal with traffic, and it's both canyons have just one lane up and one lane down, so that really tends to gum up traffic if a car gets stuck or slides or just if there's a lot of people.
So UDOT estimates, according to your story, about 1,000 cars going up and down in peak hour. That's amazing to me that little road can actually accommodate that. I guess beyond that, you get that gridlock.
Right. Yeah. Funny kind of story there is that when I first wrote that, I wrote 1,000 to 1,200 an hour or a day. And then I had to go back and look and be like, oh, no, that's actually an hour that they, when on peak times, that's how many cars go up.
You write that there'd be no gondola, right? And several other things have been ruled out. So what are they going to do? What are they thinking about?
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, no gondola. I think the idea is that, I mean, the one going up that's planned to go up Little Cottonwood Canyon, it's expected to be the longest in the world, and Big Cottonwood Canyon is even longer. So I don't think that that's I don't think that's something they are even trying to put on the table. UDOT has said that's not something they're considering. They're also not considering a train, and they're not considering widening significantly the road, like as far enough to put in an extra lane or anything like that. So with all those things they're not considering, it's basically the same things they're considering is the first steps for the Little Cottonwood Canyon, which is tolling and increased bus service.
So before we get to that, I guess, what is it again? It's Brighton and Solitude, top of Big Cottonwood.
Right.
They've tried parking reservations, right? And they say that has been helping some.
Right. Yep. They just implemented those for the first time last year. People will remember that Solitude was actually the first one in Utah to have paid parking, but they weren't doing reservations. And now both resorts are doing reservations, so you can't actually, I mean, it's just on weekends, but you generally have to get one in order to even try to find a parking spot or else risk getting a ticket.
Now, both Brighton and Solitude, I think, say that they can accommodate more skiers. I guess the bottleneck is the road.
Yes, exactly. Yep, and that's kind of the issue that everybody's trying to get around is, you know, how do you get more people up? And what UTA and UDOT are trying to do is, well, I guess UTA is trying to put more bus service. They'll have more buses, although I guess in Big Cottonwood Canyon, it's the same number of bus services, the same amount of bus service as last year. And then in Little Cottonwood Canyon, there'll be more bus service. And then they're also doing more traction checks to and encouraging carpooling.
I guess I could see that. That could create a bottleneck, right? If you get a car with bad tires, no traction, they jackknife, then everybody behind them is stuck.
Exactly. Yeah. So even on days, I've been up there for sure. On days, actually, usually it's coming home, where you are, you know, cruising down the road, and you know, it may be snowy, but not really having any trouble, and there's not a lot of traffic, and then all of a sudden you just come to a stop, and it's because a car slid out. And often, I mean, not always, but often that car, you know, either didn't have the right traction or their tread was, you know, worn down or, you know, sometimes just inexperienced drivers as well that they can't do much about. But the rest is something that they're trying to do more of this season by doing more traction checks.
So one solution they're floating is tolls. I guess this would be right up next to the ski resorts so that if you wanted to travel up the road and go off to the backcountry, you could still do that without a toll?
Right, yeah, and that's what I expect to be probably the more controversial part of this plan, and I did want to make sure I got in there that a public comment period for this UDOT plan is open from November 13th through December 13th. But one of the things I think will probably be the most controversial about it is the toll, which they, at this point, plan to start right below Solitude, so it will mostly only affect skiers and snowboarders going up to those resorts. But anyone who wants to go to, say, Donut Falls or go backcountry skiing at Cardiff Fork will still have to wait in line behind the cars that have to go through the toll.
Now, if you're carpooling, if you're a driver with a bunch of passengers, apparently, according to the floated plan, you won't get out of paying the toll.
Exactly. Yeah. So their thinking is that it's from what the UDOT representatives told me is it's too hard to find out, you know, to really monitor how many people are in a car, and doing that would slow things down too much. And so they are saying, you know, in really one car, they say it takes up as much room whether it has one person or many people. So their thought is that they just want to get those cars off the road. So you'll still have to pay what's likely going to be a very steep fine, or not steep fine, very steep toll, although UDOT has not set the prices yet for those.
So the big thing they want to do is get people into buses, right? UTA would run these buses. But I'm reading from your story that the problem there is getting enough drivers, right? It might be kind of costly.
Well, yeah, in the past it has been. This year, UTA has, you know, done quite a bit of work over the past 2 years, really, to bring their riders or their drivership up to a full roster. So they have a full roster of drivers, which is good news for everyone. But probably the better news is that they're also contracting with a third party. And that third party is the same one that was running Cottonwood Connect, which skiers and snowboarders might know as like a paid shuttle service that they could have had the last 2 years. But now those drivers will be driving UTA buses. You won't know whether it's a UTA driver probably or one of these other drivers, but that will really help as far as they just have experience in the canyons and driving in the canyons in snowy conditions. So I think that's going to be a good help. Plus, that's going to give an extra not an extra. It basically builds back in the second route, a little Cottonwood Canyon that was discontinued the last two seasons.
So the legislature apparently allocated some money for this purpose, I guess, to help in both canyons.
Right. Yep. Last season, they did that so that they could get more busing up there and try to kind of grease the skids a little bit. So more or less about $150 million that was set aside to help with the bus service and the mobility in both canyons, not just Big Cottonwood Canyon.
Now, we're looking at a future problem or a current problem in Big Cottonwood Canyon? Is a lot of days where there is gridlock, or can you mostly get up and down?
No, still it's a current problem.
Uh-huh.
It's as much, I would say, or close to as much as in Little Cottonwood Canyon, especially because going to Big Cottonwood Canyon, you know, there's a pretty sharp turn. The canyon kind of starts right there off Wasatch Boulevard, whereas Little Cottonwood Canyon, you kind of have the Wasatch Boulevard run up to get up there. It's a problem now, and it's going to be a problem for a while. One of the things that is kind of hamstringing UDOT is that they have said that they will not implement any plans that they cannot also do in Little Cottonwood Canyon. And those lawsuits I previously mentioned about the gondola are kind of keeping those things from happening. So they can increase busing, but probably not implement any tolling until all of that's taken care of.
Mm. So again, tell me about the public comment period.
Yeah, so that runs November 13th through December 13th, 13th to 13th. And it basically, if you just go to the UDOT or look up UDOT Ski Bus, you'll get to it. But they're just wondering what people think. And from the people I talked to, they said this is the most important time to make your voice heard if you have strong opinions about what should happen, because this is where they're just kind of getting ideas together and forming a plan. And then they'll have another one in the summer, I believe. But by then, they'll already have a plan in place, and it'll be a little harder to turn it around if there's something you don't like.
Okay, just a minute or two. I'd like to have you tell me about another story you've published. So Utah's ski season officially starts today. A couple of resorts are going to be opening. Which ones?
Yeah, so exciting. So Solitude will open the Wasatch. They just announced that yesterday. And Brian Head has been announcing, they've said from the beginning that they're going to open today, which I was a little dubious of when, you know, it was still 80 degrees in the middle of October, but they've managed to make it happen. So they are open as well. Brian Head down, which is kind of by Cedar City, has four runs open and top to bottom skiing off its Navajo lift. And then Solitude, for now, it's kind of a quick opener. They've got just one run off one lift. That run will have a couple of train park features on it, but it's just off their link lift. And they'll just be open through Sunday, and then they'll close down, and then they'll open up again next weekend.
All right. Exciting. Always an exciting part of the year. Salt Lake Tribune Outdoors reporter Julie Jagg has been with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune and Utah Public Radio Cache Valley reporter Clarissa Casper. Here's the headline. At the site of one of the deadliest massacres of Native Americans in U.S. history, hundreds seek to heal spirits and soil. That's coming up following a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune and Utah Public Radio Cache Valley reporter Clarissa Casper, who joins me in studio. Clarissa, thanks for coming in.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
A couple stories we want to talk about. First of these is about the a healing ceremony at the site of one of the deadliest massacres of Native Americans in U.S. history. We're talking about the Bear River Massacre. So this is near Preston, Idaho, right, in Cache Valley?
Yeah, it's just north of Preston, Idaho. You'll find it where the Bear River bends and snakes, and there's just a bunch of farmland that's been degraded over the years, but the Shoshone are trying to ecologically and spiritually restore it.
So the northwest band of the Shoshone tribe there, they've purchased this land, or at least some acres of this land, back a while, right?
Yeah, in 2017, they purchased more than 300 acres of their ancestral land.
So what do they want to do on this land?
So they want to just completely restore it to the way that it looked before any white settlers came, before the massacre happened. So they're looking to plant over 300,000 native trees and shrubs. They're looking to restore the creeks and the streams by building beaver analogs, which are basically just beaver dams built by humans to try and reintroduce beavers. They're trying to reintroduce bears. They're really just trying to bring back all of the native vegetation and wildlife that existed before 1863. They're also taking out the invasive plants, Russian olive trees.
Right. Russian olive trees, I think they were described, I can't remember, as sugar candy for animals. They're high in sugar content, but not much nutrition.
Yeah. They have these olives that are high in sugar, so when the wildlife feeds on them, they're just basically eating junk food.
Plus, they suck up a lot of water, I think, right, and then prevent the river from kind of expanding into a wetlands.
Yeah. They siphon up about 75 gallons a day each tree. So I talked to some experts who said that's 75 gallons that could be going to the Great Salt Lake.
So imagine this is taking a lot of money. The tribe has raised a bunch of money?
Yeah, they've raised money through grants and through fundraising, but they haven't used a single penny of government funds for this.
So tell me about the, what do we call this, ceremony, activity? Mostly it was tree planting, right, that you went to. Did they just invite the public once a year?
Yeah, so this was the second year that they've held an annual tree planting at the site to help restore the area. So they need lots of help. They can't do it all themselves. There's 300,000 native shrubs and trees to plant and creeks to restore and stuff. So they invite the public once a year to come help out and plant, because it takes a lot of hands to plant that many trees. So, yeah, there was about 200 people on Friday when I went, but I heard that on Saturday there was triple that. So, yeah, they're also looking for more people to come help today, actually.
Okay. How do you connect? I guess you just show up out there?
Yeah, just show up.
Show up out there near Preston. You talked to Rios Pacheco, who's the spiritual leader, I think, for the Northwestern Band. He said planting trees is not only ecologically good, but it's spiritually good.
Yeah. He kind of described it as like... his ancestors put out his seeds, and he's now doing the work of restoring the land, like how a plant puts out a seed and then it regrows into a new tree later on.
I think kind of the final plans, there's going to be an amphitheater out there, right, where they can tell the stories from their perspective.
Yeah. They want to have an amphitheater. They want to have a walking trail through the site that people can go do an interactive walk through.
So you talked to several. One that I noticed, a teacher brought a whole class from Roland Hall in Salt Lake. I guess they bussed up and they were helping. What were they saying?
Yeah, there was a few, about 15 eighth graders there on Friday that I got a talk with. They were having fun digging holes, and I have a picture of one of the eighth graders sitting in one of the holes. They were having a good time, but yeah, the teacher said he thought it was really important to bring his students up to the site because they're learning about Native American literature in their English class right now, and he thought it would be a really good way to get them out there and get them hands-on in the dirt and experiencing something like that. And the students loved it. They were having a blast.
You also talked to Tribal Council Chair Dennis Alex. What did he say?
he was just talking about how inspiring it was to see so many people come together. It was very heartwarming for him to see the different people who had come together to help his tribe and to help with the effort.
What were some other people saying?
People were just there talking about, you know, why they're doing it. I talked to one woman who said that she was there because she had a friend who recently passed away, and so she was there to honor her friend, but also to help out with the tribe. But, yeah, everyone seemed to have their own reason for helping. Some people just love planting trees, and they were like, that's a perfect place to go plant trees. And other people have a personal connection to the tribes. Other people have personal connection to the land. I talked to some people who are from Idaho who have ancestors who helped members of the tribe at the time, who took them in after the massacre and stuff like that. So, yeah, I just talked to a lot of different people with different perspectives on why they were helping.
Do they have a timeline when they want to get all the trees planted and everything done?
I'm not quite sure. I know they want to do it soon.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this was the second sort of become an annual thing.
Yeah.
Maybe a third next year.
We'll yeah.
We'll see. Yeah. Well, thanks for telling us about this. I want to move on here before we go into Underplayed Stories. A story here in Logan that's gotten quite a bit of interest. Here's the headline. This Utah city wants to remove century-old trees. Residents are fighting back. The subheadline, more than 1,000 have signed grassroots petition to uproot the waterline project. So we're talking about Logan, mm-hmm. and this is the island area, right?
Yeah, so the area just kind of that hugs the mountains that's right before you get to Logan Canyon, that little area.
So we're talking about some ash trees. There's some photos in the story, right? These are 100 years old ash trees, very, very large.
Yeah, they're 107 years old. The people who live by them just love them. They turn a glowing color in the fall. They're bright green in the summer. They're giant, and they just tower over the street.
Now they're quite close to the street, right? That's part of the controversy. So what does the city want to do?
So the city is being required by the state of Utah to put in a water line and water tank because of Logan's growing population, to funnel water to the west end of town from the canyon. So the city needs to put in a water line somewhere. So they've landed on Canyon Road as the best place to lay the line under. And there were other alternatives, but I don't really know the details of those. They said that they'll send me the details soon. But yeah, so they've decided on Canyon Road, and they decided that since they're going to do Canyon Road, they might as well revamp the street. So it's kind of a historic street that hasn't been updated in a long time. So it's lacking sidewalks in a lot of places. It doesn't have bike lanes. It doesn't have a lot of those things that are in our more modern neighborhood. And so the city decided, oh, well, since we're going to run the water line under Canyon Road, let's bring it up to speed and put some sidewalks in there. They're thinking about putting bike lanes, maybe a bike path, I heard. So, yeah, so it's kind of this, they're looking at redoing the whole street and laying a water line all in the same thing. But lots of residents wonder if there's other alternatives to their street.
So a lot of residents are saying, we love those trees, and we don't want this project, we want the trees.
Right, right? Yeah. And, like, the trees couldn't remain if they did the project because the water line would cut all of their roots and they would die.
Mm-hmm. You talked to a certified arborist, I think, whatever his title is, right? What does he say about the trees?
So, yeah, I talked to the certified master arborist, Mark Malmstrom, who he examined the trees for the city in 2022 to see whether they are worthy of preservation. And he said that if they go through with the project, the trees will die. They're doomed if they go through with the project. But his personal opinion is if there's a way to save the trees, that they should, because they're magnificent to him. And he called them landmarks.
Mm-hmm. I think he says in the wild, these ash trees could grow to 400 years or something. In this urban setting, I guess it's more like 200 years, but still they got another 100 years to go potentially.
Yeah, yeah. In the wild, they're not hit by cars and stuff like some of the trees on Canyon Road have been. So, but yeah.
And there's a photo you have where somebody's pointing to a scar on one of the trees which was hit by a car, right?
Yeah, yeah. Mark said that, you know, all the trees are not in perfect health, but they're still they're still standing.
So Logan City, Mayor Danes, she says, well, that as a part of this plan, they would plant trees, and within the lifetime, at least of the children in that area, you'd have mature trees.
Yeah, yeah. She said she really wants her constituents to think about the future and what the next 50 to 100 years could look like on that street.
So these residents have got a petition going, more than 1,000 signatures.
Yeah, I looked just now. It's actually 1,800 now.
1,800, yeah. Any word from the city on whether this will have an effect?
Nope, I haven't heard from the city. I did hear, I watched the Logan City Council meeting on Tuesday night, and they are going to hold a open house in early December for residents to come express their concerns and their wants with the road improvements.
Yeah. In the meantime, I guess from the city's perspective, they would say we got to put this water line in somewhere. You say there might be some alternative paths you don't know yet.
Yeah, they mentioned some alternative paths, like perhaps going down 400 North, or I heard some people talking about putting it under the canal on that trail. But yeah, it seems that the city's landed on the Canyon Road for some reason. They said they'll send me a statement soon on why.
Yeah. And in the meantime, as you report in your story, that I guess at least 1,800 people don't want this.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So if you live in Logan, maybe, you know, take a little drive, take a look at those ash trees. Canyon Road in the island area, right?
Yeah.
So where you would go. Clarissa Casper, who's Utah Public Radio and Salt Lake Tribune, Cache Valley reporter, thanks for telling us about both these stories.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, it's time for our underplayed stories of the week. We'll start with Robert Gerke. What's your underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I'm going to go with another election story that I helped report along with Courtney Tanner and Emily Anderson Stern, just about the long lines that we had in Utah County. They didn't have adequate polling places. They didn't have enough paper to print provisional ballots, and it required the state to sort of rush one of the state airplanes down to Phoenix to pick up more paper. It was a big fiasco, and you can check out all the reasons why at sltrib.com.
Yeah, it's a very interesting story. Yeah, thanks for recommending that one. sltrib.com for that one. Clarissa, what's your underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, we had a similar situation in Cache County, but not as bad. My underplayed story of the week is Palak J. Swall's story. It's a more lighthearted story this week about a Saratoga Springs author who paid off her family's medical debt by writing a book in 39 days. I just was blown away by this story. It was such a good, uplifting story.
That's amazing. Soraya Wilson, I had the opportunity to interview her on Access Utah. She's pretty interesting. Romance author, right?
Yeah, but she wrote a fantasy romance novel.
Oh, yeah. I was able to pay off that debt
through
writing, yeah. Maybe inspire some of the rest of us to do some of that.
Yeah.
So you can find that story from Palak on sltrib.com as well. Well, we've reached the end of our time here. We earlier heard a recorded interview I recorded yesterday with Julie Jagg, outdoors reporter. We've been talking with news columnist Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom.
Thank you. And Clarissa Casper, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Clarissa Casper is Salt Lake Tribune and Utah Public Radio Cache Valley reporter. Thanks, everyone, for listening. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll join me again next time. Thank you.